You're listening to Community Radio, KHOI, 89.1, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Pat Schlarbaum, and later on we'll be joined with Greta Anderson. And also in the studio this morning, we have Doug Haar. Good morning, Doug.
Morning, Pat.
This is a great opportunity to learn about birds and bird conservation areas. Doug is the president of the Iowa Audubon here in Iowa. So for today, let's talk about phenology. Let's have some updates on birding. And I was asked recently, where are all the songbirds this time of year, Doug?
Well, that's a good question. That's one that I get asked once in a while, too. And it's really a case of we're at the end of the nesting season for our birds. And once they're done nesting, a lot of them just quiet down and take care of their young. And so we're not seeing a lot of activity right now. Plus, some are starting to pull out already on migration.
I see some of the birds flocking up. You see the blackbirds and it is, we're moving along in the season. Have some birds already started their movement back to Central or South America?
Yes, they have. Bobolinks, sort of an iconic grassland bird, they've started to pull out. And recently I've noticed some big numbers of shorebirds moving into this area from the Arctic and subarctic areas already. So they're already moving into the Central Plains states here on their way south.
And they've been in the Arctic, the shorebirds?
Yes.
In a primary nesting area. So isn't that fascinating here in the first part of August?
Yes. In fact, some of those birds actually show up in late July, some of those shorebirds. They have about a two-month nesting season up in the Arctic, subarctic area, and then they turn around and head right back south again.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. In Iowa, being along the Mississippi Flyway, one of the greatest flyways on the North American continent.
Right. We get a lot of migration through this part of the country.
And another bird that people have been wondering about, I'm sure, are the peregrine falcons. Earlier, we had some updates about the falcons in Des Moines. I'd like to share that a lot of the birding reports include peregrine falcons when they see the shorebirds. Is there a biological reason that those peregrines follow those shorebirds this time of year?
Well, I'm not an expert on peregrine falcons, but I think there is a proclivity of those birds to follow some of the things that are going to be their prey that they're looking to eat.
Yeah, and we do have the opportunity to see peregrine falcons in downtown Des Moines. Recently, there were two that fledged from the American Enterprise Building in 6th and Grand in Des Moines downtown, and also at the state capitol. We had a bird that was captured. It was on the ground. It had some difficulties in its first fledging activity, its first flight. That bird was taken to the Saving Our Avian Resources facility near Dedham, Iowa, and Kay Newman has been working with that bird. It had detectable levels of lead in its system. And so the mystery now is, wonder what it ate to have that lead in its system. And we feel that it kind of impaired its development right at flight time.
That's really interesting. I mean, things like eagles, which feed on things that have been shot, sometimes, will pick up lead. But peregrines they're not scavengers the way eagles are.
It is a mystery. It does point out the biological indicator species that the peregrines are providing at the top of the mm-hmm. food chain. Everything in the food chain ultimately affects those top of the food chain birds like peregrine falcons.
Yes, it does, and that's why we lost so many birds with DDT back in the 60s and 70s, because it all funneled up to the top of that food chain.
Sure enough. Well, there'll be further developments. We're hoping that bird can be returned to the Capitol and set free in the coming weeks. But just to kind of also, we were talking about the birds flocking and the goldfinches, our state bird. Has it initiated nesting? It's probably one of the last nesters.
Yes, it is one of the last nesting songbirds in the Midwest, and they are nesting now. I have seen females carrying nesting material in the last few weeks, so and seeing a lot of males flying around and not so many females right now, so I suspect a lot of them are on the nest right now.
Now, is that nesting material, is that like the strands from ragweed or what?
They use a lot of really fine material. The thistle down is one of their favorite things to line a nest with to make it really soft. Yeah. And so one of the things that really has – that they've evolved to do is sort of coordinate their nesting period with the maturity of the thistles when they can take all that thistle down to line the nest.
Yeah. And something else I'd like to bring up. We have bluebirds that are probably initiating their third nesting attempt. They're kind of elongated nesting season. There is an opportunity for people that enjoy bluebirds and bluebirding to go down to the state fair on Sunday coming up. There's an extreme Sunday kind of focus, and the Wild Turkey Federation will be at the Department of Natural Resources building right there on the west side of the Grand Concourse of the State Fair, and they will be making and distributing bluebird boxes for people that would enjoy learning more about these fascinating birds. And with that, let's bring on the bluebird song, and we'll get ready for the rest of our program.
Listen to my bluebird laugh, she can't tell you why. Deep within her heart, you see, she knows all I crying, just lying. Yeah. There she sits, a lofty perch, strangest color blue, lying is forgotten now, thinks only of you, just you. Oh, so get all those blues, must be a thousand hues, and each is differently used, you just know, you sit there mesmerized.
Welcome back. Doug, the bluebirds, the bluebird of happiness kind of sets the tone here. Around Iowa, there have been considerable areas added to the public landscape where we have an opportunity now over by Ogden to enjoy a public area. You mentioned the shorebirds. There's bluebirds. You mentioned the bobolinks singing from the top of the compass plants. How did Harrier come about? How can you explain the Prairie Pothole Joint Venture?
Well, the Prairie Pothole Joint Venture is actually a cooperative effort between the state and federal governments and also some private conservation organization like Ducks Unlimited and other groups. And basically, it was a program put together to try to gather all the funding that was possible and put together fairly large areas of wetland and grasslands that could be preserved for bird habitat. And over the years, it's sort of grown here in Iowa to where the state of Iowa and a number of the county conservation boards and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have put together these very large wetland grassland complexes, especially if you get up into the northern part of the state, the Iowa Great Lakes region and up around the Clear Lake Mason City area. But then there are other ones scattered throughout the central part of the state on the Des Moines Lobe, the old glacial landscape. And one of those is Harrier Marsh right south of Ogden. It's just almost across the street from me. I live in Ogden and about three blocks from it and can hike over and watch birds there anytime. And it's, I forget the exact acreage, it's between 400 and 500 acres total. And it is just a marvelous place for all sorts of birds, grassland birds, water birds, migrating birds of all kinds. We see all sorts of raptors out there on migration. So it's really a great place
for
birds.
What are some of the raptors?
Oh, we see harriers, northern harriers, after the name is the area is named after the northern harrier. I don't know if they've actually nested there, but I have seen them during the summer, so there's some possibility that they might actually be nesting there. They're certainly seen on spring and fall migration. Sometimes during the winter, you can see a rare short-eared owl out there. I have seen merlins in migration over the area.
Oh, now merlins, they're a cousin to the peregrine falcon?
Right. They're sort of a medium-sized falcon between the American kestrel, sometimes called sparrowhawk, and the larger peregrine falcon. Mm-hmm. There's something in between. And then during the winter, a bird that you often see out there is the rough-legged hawk, which is actually an Arctic hawk and comes down here to spend the enjoyable warm winters in Iowa to get away from the Arctic cold.
Yeah. But these birds specifically require large-scale areas.
Yes, there are a number of species that are what we call area sensitive. In other words, they're not going to get by on a patch of 4 or 5 acres of grass and marsh. They've got to have 40, 50 acres, 100 acres, 500 acres, depending on the bird. Some birds are more area sensitive than others. But things like bobolinks need a minimum of about 40 acres of good grassland habitat in order to be able to successfully nest and raise young.
Mm-hmm. So 40 acres, we'd like to expand it to 400 and possibly 4,000.
As much as possible, because that will provide a lot more habitat for a lot more birds.
Well, Doug Hart, you seem to be quite suited for this type of bird activity as president of Iowa Audubon. What was your career previously before you retired?
Well, I spent a little over 38 years with the Department of Natural Resources, first as a wildlife manager up in northwest Iowa, the Iowa Great Lakes area over to the South Dakota border, and then came down to central Iowa in 2001 to join the Wildlife Diversity, the non-game program of DNR, and that's the way I finished up my career and really enjoyed it.
Well, and we mentioned the Prairie Pothole Joint Venture, and you were deep in the heart of that in northwest Iowa.
Yes.
But I'd like the listeners to realize that Harrier was the southern extent of this Des Moines Lobe that had the potholes, that specific habitat type that these shorebirds and these prairie species were we were inviting. The but most of the money was going, seemed like, further upstream, it seemed. And Harrier was really a great opportunity for local central Iowa people to have one of these special areas.
It is. One of the reasons the money all went upstream to start with, the early years, a lot of the prairie pothole restoration work and the land acquisition was done in northern Iowa because of the more rugged glacial moraine or terrain up there. It's hillier, rockier, little less farmable than the flatlands here of central Iowa.
Yeah.
But eventually it was realized that there was some really good potential just west of Boone out there in the Ogden area. There's lots of old drained potholes. And once the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Iowa DNR were able to acquire that 400 to 500 acres there along Highway 30, it was relatively easy to go in and break the tiles and restore the wetlands there and then reseed the prairie to recreate that historic landscape.
So it sounds like the tiles that were taking the water away into the Des Moines River watershed, setting it downriver, then you directed it back to these potholes that were there historically.
Yes, that's right. And of course, that serves one more function in helping clean up a little of the water that's going into the Des Moines River by keeping it in place in those pothole basins.
Sure, there's a filtration system.
Right.
It's like the kidneys of the
right.
of the Earth's biome. Well, let's also include Colo, the Colo Bogs over in eastern Story County. That's a nice compliment to Harrier.
It is. You kind of look at Ames here in the middle between these two areas. They're about almost equidistant either side of Ames, and they're quite similar in a lot of ways. Now, Colo Bogs has just a little bit more undulating landscape. Harrier is just a little bit flatter.
Rolling along.
A little more rolling. Mm-hmm. But one of the really interesting things about Colo Bogs is the way the marshes dry up and refill with water there leaves mud flats in the spring and fall. And it is one of the best places in central Iowa to find migrating shorebirds. So As we're getting into this fall migration season right now, if people want to see a variety of shorebirds, that's just a wonderful place to go.
And who are the partners when we mention these Department of Natural Resource areas? But there's local partners.
There are local partners. County conservation boards are very often involved in a number of these areas.
Oh, sure.
As landowners, as co-landowners along with DNR or the Fish and Wildlife Service. But then there are other partners that are fundraisers as well. I mean, groups like Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited and even the Audubon Society, although we're small by comparison to those other groups, there's just all sorts of organizations, conservation organizations, that have contributed to the partnership to make these areas possible.
I know Hank Zalatel with local Pheasants Forever and a great birder. Has been instrumental in that Colo Bogs area. And he's taken other birders from Iowa City around. And how is it that we were so fortunate? And Hank is quick to point out that he was the bridge between Pheasants Forever, the birding community. These are things that hunting is allowed, but
right.
only a short window of the year. And there's so many other good things going on there at Colo Bogs.
There is. And, I mean, that's one of the things about many of the areas that DNR, the Fish and Wildlife Service, or county conservation boards own is that, they may be hunted during the fall and early winter months, but the rest of the year they're open for all kinds of other nature activities. Yeah. Anybody who's interested in everything from birds to butterflies can find some interesting stuff on these areas.
So the agencies and then the non-governmental agencies like Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, the Iowa Audubon are involved. Let's develop this also. I understand there's matching funds from REAP.
That's right.
The Resource Enhancement and Protection Act of 1988 has been what were the goals initially for the REAP legislation?
Well, I guess that's probably a little bit beyond me because I was up in Northwest Iowa at that time working in the field and really didn't have a lot to do with the origination of the REAP Act.
Yeah.
But I just got to use some of it after time.
Yeah. Initially, they wanted $30 million for 20 years.
Right.
And then the legislature would appropriate. And some years, unfortunately, it was zeroed out. In other years recently, it was for the 25th anniversary of the REAP legislation, there was a goal of having $25 million. Unfortunately, that was cut.
We came very close. The legislature actually did a bipartisan thing and agreed to it, but then there was some line items cuts made after the legislature adjourned, and so REAP didn't end up getting the full funding.
But REAP is synonymous with any wildlife area funding in the last 25 years.
It has had a lot to do with a lot of the wildlife areas all across the state.
It's been huge. Mm-hmm. IWIL was the Iowa Water and Land Legacy Act. Now, this is funding for the future. And I understand you were a part of that initial committee that was designated by the legislature to come up with a plan to fund public areas in Iowa.
Yeah, I was actually sort of an advisor to the committee, not a member of the committee. The committee was legislatively appointed, but it took a number of advisors from different organizations and agencies, and I was appointed by DNR to be one of the advisors to this committee and help guide it along as it pursued this idea of a constitutional amendment to eventually provide some permanent funding for natural resources in Iowa.
And when the legislation was initiated, I don't recall there was a need for this type of funding, but to put it in the Constitution, that was a whole nother campaign, so to speak. It had to pass through two sessions of the legislature, and then it was put to a general vote in 2010.
Right. And, a vote of the public in the fall election, and it passed with an amazing 63% majority. 63% of the voters in Iowa agreed that there should be a constitutionally protected fund available at some point in the future for natural resources. That would be dependent on sales tax in the future, an additional sales tax, 0.375%, but at least the constitutional amendment was passed. It's there, and we only need the money now at this point.
Yeah, so it's time to get organized to encourage our legislature now to come up with a plan. There's been a couple creative ideas. Rather than raising the sales tax one cent, that seems to be an obstacle or a hurdle. But there ought to be a way.
There should be, and there's a number of different things being talked about now. Over the last year or so, the big push with a lot of the conservation community has been to try to get the full funding of REAP. But now, at this point, now they're beginning to roll out the I Will program again. There's some meetings coming up, and they're going to be talking about ways to try to get this sales tax instituted at some point in the future and see that that permanent funding is established.
And Greta, would you?
Yeah, I was just, you know, these places that you've described, the Harrier Marsh in Ogden, the Colo Bogs, they sound like really wonderful places. And I wondered, for a visitor, somebody who's never been there before, is part of the funding for things like a parking lot where people can go and signage? And is there a way that you could direct people to those places?
There certainly is funding. I mean, when these areas are established, because they are public areas, there's always a plan that will allow for public access. So there are parking areas established around each of these areas, almost all the major wildlife areas in the state. There are guides to them, maps online through the Department of Natural Resources and other organizations. For a lot of the areas here in central Iowa, there's a publication called the Makoki Bird Trail Guide that will lead visitors to 22 of the best birdwatching areas within about an hour's drive of Des Moines. And so you can take this little booklet, which is available through DNR and county conservation boards, a lot of different places. Some of the visitor centers along the interstate have them. And this little booklet is just a beautiful little booklet developed with aerial photo maps of the area showing you the best birdwatching spots, telling you all about what sorts of birds are there. And I would say that's probably one of the best best means of finding out a lot more about all these areas in central Iowa.
Well, thanks. And you say that you live right across from Harrier Marsh, and I was wondering, how long have you lived there? What changes have you seen over the years?
Well, we moved to Ogden in 2001, and the area had just been developed over the few years there in the late 90s. And so we got there when the area was just – a lot of the prairies had been reseeded and the wetland restorations had just been completed. So we've really seen it sort of evolve into a much more natural ecosystem over the years. And when I was still with DNR, I was doing bird surveys and other sorts of natural surveys out there. And now I still do them as a volunteer basis. And so I've been able to see the changes in the vegetative community and the plant community and the bird community and how things are evolving back into a much more natural ecosystem. We've even found wild orchids out there in September in an area that was once all cornfield and beans. So this, I mean, that was just amazing to me that orchids could be growing out in naturally. They weren't planted there. They just showed up after the area had evolved for a few years.
And so that would happen because a bird would have carried something?
That's a good question. With something like orchids, which are really quite a difficult plant to establish and seed because they're small seed and they're need for fungi in the surface of the soil. I'm not really sure how they got there, but it was just really interesting to see them there.
A mystery of nature.
Yes.
Gotta love it.
And butterflies over the years, I'm curious about.
Butterflies, yes. I mean, you can go out to an area at this time of year, any prairie at this time of year with all its wildflowers. And, you know, August is one of the beautiful times for prairie wildflowers. The purples and the oranges and the yellows are just abounding. And the butterflies are just in hordes on some of these prairies. And I was out on Harrier Marsh Sunday afternoon. I took a little walk out there, and there was fritillary butterflies and monarchs and swallowtails. And I'm not a butterfly expert, and I couldn't even name all of them that I was seeing out there, but it was just a beautiful array of things.
But to mention fritillaries right here in central Iowa is that's a species that's been a long time gone.
Yeah, there are some common varieties, but then there's things like regal fritillaries. I'm not sure if they have been found on Harrier Marsh yet. For example, down at Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge southeast of Des Moines, they actually had to restock regal fritillaries there in order to get them reestablished on that prairie because it was so far from any existing prairie that it was too far for the butterflies to fly from one prairie to another. So sometimes when you have an isolated area that's been reestablished in prairie, sometimes you actually have to bring some of that breeding stock in, if you want to call it that, to establish it on an area.
But build a habitat. Many things will come.
Many things will come. Some you have to drive there, but a lot of them will come on their own.
Yeah. Well, and that's great to bring up the Neil Smith, just essentially downstream once again. Let's talk about the Chautauqua area. Isn't there a bird conservation area?
Yes. The Chautauqua Neil Smith Bird Conservation Area is the name of it. And it actually combines the two major areas. Chautauqua, I believe, is a little over 6,000 acres in size, and Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, about 20 miles south of it, is around 5,500 acres in size. So between the two of them, they're approaching 12,000 acres of public land. And then the bird conservation area actually includes a lot of private land around those and between the two of them. Yeah. So it's really a very large landscape, and those two areas serve as core habitats within this large designated bird conservation area.
The core meaning the upwards of 2,000, 3,000 acres of public lands that can be kind of managed for wildlife specifically.
Right.
But the bird conservation area that encompasses the surrounding.
Right. The idea of the bird conservation area actually came out of an organization, a national group called a Partners in Flight, which was established by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service back in the early 90s. And it involves federal and state agencies and many private partner organizations, again, in developing one of the many things that they do is this development of an idea of a bird conservation area. Actually developed by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in cooperation with Partners in Flight. And Iowa Department of Natural Resources back in the late 90s decided to jump on the bandwagon and adopt this idea of the bird conservation areas. And today, as a result of that, we have 18 bird conservation areas established across the state of Iowa. I think the smallest one is in the range of 10 to 14,000 acres, and the largest ones, a couple of them up in the 130 to 135,000 acre range. And just a percentage of those, basically about 20%, is actually in public ownership. All the rest of it is private land, and the goal there is to try to work with those private landowners to get them to do more habitat management on their land to benefit the birds on private land at all, as well as on the public land.
Yeah, so the buffers, any prairie seeding, any grassland seeding for a grassland, a bird conservation area, would contribute to that mosaic of habitat types in that bird conservation area.
Right. And that's what they're really looking for, you know, is a mosaic of land, especially on that private land, because with the core areas serving to provide some good basic habitat for the birds, then if the private landowners around there have some grasslands or some wetlands or some woodlands on their property, then there is a source of birds that can move into those and expand their population across that whole BCA landscape.
Yeah, our logo for the upcoming Grassroots Radio Conference is a prairie chicken. It's my understanding that Kellerton, the bird conservation area, the Grand River Grasslands bird conservation area, that does include the prairie chickens in southern Iowa.
Right, and that was actually the first grassland bird conservation area in the United States, so Iowa has something to be real proud of with that.
Mm-hmm. Could it ultimately be a globally significant bird conservation
that
area?
One could be. There is a designation by BirdLife International from the United Kingdom, and they work with partner organizations around the world. In the United States, it's the National Audubon Society that gives designation to certain areas as globally important bird areas. Now, we have one of those in Iowa already, in northeast Iowa, Yellow River Forest Effigy Mound bird conservation area has been designated by BirdLife International and the National Audubon Society as a globally important bird area because of a fairly rare bird that nests in great numbers up there called the cerulean warbler. There's a possibility, I think, that the Kellerton bird conservation area would be another good candidate. Not only for its prairie chickens, but it probably has one of the larger populations of Henslow sparrows and grasshopper sparrows in the central United States. And those are birds which could be used with enough good scientific data over a few years. There would be enough there, I think, to get a global designation for that area.
So I guess so many of us, when we hear sparrows, we think of the English sparrows. But you mentioned grasshopper sparrows?
Yeah, grasshopper sparrows and Henslow sparrows are a couple of types of native sparrows, unlike the house sparrow or English sparrow, which was brought over to this continent early pioneers coming from Europe. But we have many, many native sparrows, a lot of those are grassland birds, and two of the real important ones in Iowa are, because of their decline, are Henslows and grasshopper sparrows.
Well, this is pretty exciting when you think that Iowa can almost unite with northern Missouri, and we can have an area that people from around the world can come to southern Iowa and see songbirds that is in peril, in jeopardy. The grassland birds are probably the most persecuted, or it's their habitat types that we need to really focus on and generate more interest and more growth in that area.
It is, and it's a great place for anybody who's never seen a prairie chicken to go see a prairie chicken on the booming grounds in the spring, because it's just about the only place in Iowa you can do that today.
Yeah, yahoo. We'll go to Universal Mother. I'm going to play this song by John Stravers. He's a musician, but he's also quite a birder. And in northeast Iowa, he was instrumental in the globally significant bird conservation area of Effigy Mounds, Yellow River Forest.
Thank you. standing in the rain. It's gonna let that sacred water wash away his sorrow and his pain. 100 generations waited for this to be clear, ruled by what we love and not by what we fear. Feel a chance to change. Gonna work for change.
Was Big Blue Sky, John Strauber's band from Northeast Iowa. Doug, let's take a moment to talk about the 4th Annual Pelican Festival that's coming up at the Coralville Reservoir. And then I understand Iowa Audubon's going to be one of the presenters.
Right. Iowa Audubon has been a longtime sponsor of the Pelican Festival. It formerly was held down here on Sailorville Reservoir, but 4 years ago we decided to try it in a little different part of the state to get some more people exposed to some of our natural resources. So we moved it to Coralville Lake, and this is the fourth year now that we've had it over there.
Sunday, September 7th.
Right. From 11 to 4 p.m., 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and there should be lots of pelicans on the lake. They're in migration at this time of year. They're starting to come through already, and usually the end of August, early September, they really populate these large reservoirs in Iowa. So for people who, you know, there's a lot of people who don't realize that we have pelicans in Iowa, that they actually, some of them live in Iowa during the summer, but a lot migrate through in the fall, and this is a festival about them. So
yeah, I would be one of those people who didn't know until last weekend. I was out on the Des Moines River, and I was with someone who, with a little more experience, and we saw this amazing flock of birds that, you know, they go in one direction and they're white, and then all of a sudden they all disappear.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
And then they turn black, and then they turn white. Yeah. It's just amazing.
They have black on their wings, and as the sun shines, they fly in synchrony, and they do seem to almost disappear, and then they start twinkling back. Isn't it remarkable?
Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah. It's one of those beautiful sights of nature you just can't get over once you've seen it.
Yeah. And they'll be right out in front of us there with the spotting scopes and things. And have you ever seen them fish? They line up. Yeah. Another point of synchrony. They'll all get in a line, and they kind of school the fish into shallower shore, and then they all dip at the same time. And it's just remarkable.
Yeah, which is really amazing. I mean, a lot of people think of the pelicans on the coast and see them diving for fish, but our white pelicans don't do that. They've got this – they're team fishing is what they're doing out there on the lakes.
Yeah. And you say they migrate here. There's so there's some immatures that are
– There are some immatures that spend the summer on the lakes, especially in northern Iowa. So if you go to Spirit Lake, Clear Lake, some of those areas, you will see pelicans during the summer. And a lot of those are birds that are not old enough yet to nest. They don't reach maturity until about 3 years old. And rather than compete with the adults for the food sources up in the alkaline marshes of the Dakotas and on into Canada, western Minnesota, where they nest, a lot of those immature birds will stay a little bit further south and just fish and feed on their own during the summer, and then not compete with the adults who are trying to feed their young on the big nesting lakes up north.
And when we mention fish, I think it's the gizzard shad that are in our large reservoirs.
Right. Gizzard shad is probably their primary food source
and
in our large reservoirs.
Like a bait fish?
Right, right. It's a big it's a schooling fish and very often can overpopulate a lake. Mm-hmm. So it's really – the pelicans are really doing us a favor and help keeping those fish populations in balance by feeding on things like that. And then in the natural lakes, they'll eat a lot of bullheads and things like that, little schooling bullheads.
And there are other associated activities. There's some other presenters.
Right. We will have a series of programs of talks, of 20, 25-minute talks about pelicans and other wildlife. And there will be all sorts of displays from different conservation organizations. There'll be food served on the ground by a Boy Scout troop. And so it's just a good get-to-know-nature experience. That
quite a community activity. It sounds like you got the agency people there. You've got the private birding organizations. I know it's a good opportunity to learn about Jim Walter's Songbird Project right out of Iowa City. Do you know about the Althea Sherman Swift Tower?
Yes, I know a little bit about it. I haven't actually ever been to see it. I've read a lot about it and I've talked to Jim about it, but I understand they actually had some chimney swifts start nesting in that tower this year for the first time.
Yeah, Althea Sherman was one of the leading matriarchs of birding in Iowa at the turn of the 20th century and had this chimney design that the chimney swifts would go down into and nest, and then she had her windows and the little stairway. And the Johnson County Songbird Project have refurbished that and placed it in Chickasaw County now. And the chimney swifts are returning.
Right, and that's really neat. It's a historical structure, and this is a bird which is in decline, too, so it's really great to see them actually using this structure.
Yeah, so there's way more to learn about than just the pelicans, but that's our focus species. And my goodness, to see them fly, to see them fish, it's really quite a remarkable show. And we might mention that they are nesting once again in Iowa after an absence of about 125 years.
Yes, they have. They've established a colony over on the Mississippi River the past, two or three years, I think, they've been nesting over there. And they've attempted to nest up in northern Iowa, too, but they've had some nest predation from raccoons and haven't been successful up there. But I think there's a possibility they may eventually be able to reestablish colonies in northern Iowa,
too. So what would be considered their nesting habitat?
They like islands in particular because it's relatively safe from predation. Mm-hmm. They are a ground nesting bird, of course. They just make a little scrape in the sand or the soil and lay their eggs in a little depression. And so if they can be on an island of some sort there, that gives them a lot of protection. So that's the type of habitat they're looking for.
There are other colonial water birds, cormorants and along those nesting islands, so there's more than pelicans.
There's some gull colonies now established in Iowa, too, on the Mississippi River and in the Spirit Lake area.
So nature seems to be giving us some guidance and encouraging us.
Making a little comeback in some places.
Encouraging us to do more, yeah.
We're talking with Doug Haar. He's the president of the Iowa Audubon Association.
And let's kind of wrap this up. Another bird conservation area then is Boone Forks. We talked about the grasslands. Let's get on the water. Let's talk about water.
Yeah. Boone Forks is just a beautiful area. It's basically where the Boone River meets the Des Moines River, and there are parcels of public land up and down both of the rivers at that point. And a lot of it's forest, and then there's a lot of grasslands that have been seeded down along either side of the Boone River. And part of the real benefit of this bird conservation area is that it's helping protect the water quality of the Boone River, which I think is one of the most beautiful rivers in Central Iowa.
Pretty well-kept secret.
Yes, it is.
But a resource that's easily enjoyed. We can gain hope. I think the bird conservation areas can give us a glimpse into our heritage. We can go there. We can see things. We can realize the importance of these habitat areas of woodland, riparian, grasslands. But it's the clean water. It's all about water. Anything we can do to filter the water, to slow it down, let it meander. Chautauqua is just a great area to see those backwaters.
We're talking about clean water, and we have on the phone someone who is passionate about that topic. On the west side of the Des Moines Lobe, he's been working with the Raccoon River Watershed Association, and he is currently the president of Citizens for Healthy Iowa, Michael Delaney. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Greta. And thank you, Doug Haar, for all your good work with the birds.
All right. Michael, you have an event coming up that you're trying to raise interest in, but let's talk about what you've been up to over the past 10 years or so on the Des Moines River.
All right. I retired from full-time teaching of sociology at Des Moines Area Community College in 2005 and started the Raccoon River Watershed Association with seven other people. And our mission statement is to preserve and enhance the river and watershed. So we're interested in the birds and we're interested in the fish. We're interested in habitat, but most interested in water quality.
And how has that been going for you? What efforts have you made or inroads?
Well, it was because of our overall interest in the whole watershed and all sorts of all forms of capital, from natural capital all the way up to social, political, and economic capital. We really tried to work comprehensively to get the people to think, first of all, in terms of the watershed, to know what it is and their place in it. We distributed videotapes that were done on what a watershed is, hundreds of them to students and adults and libraries and schools in the area. We also engaged in an effort to create the Raccoon River Water Trail to encourage people to get out and float down the river so they have an intimate relationship with the river. They know where it goes and they know the condition and all. Then we did a 180-mile float, some of us, and stopped at communities along the way and visited with people and talked to them about our goals. We've done a lot of cleanups, picked up trash. Project Aware came down the Raccoon River, and we took 17 tons of trash out of the river. There are still some big things like buses and cars still along the bank that are very hard to get out, but we've done a good job in picking up after the fishermen who leave their trash behind, or the high school kids who have their parties on the sandbars, and well, there's always tires to pick up and old farm equipment. But the good news is once you get trash picked up in a river, it tends to stay a lot better because a lot of trash is old. People used to think of the river as a dump for whatever, including, you know, hog carcasses and all that. The meat packers didn't have much in the way of standards until the Clean Water Act. The rivers were seen as just a way of disposing of stuff. The industrial users and the cities have done a great deal since the Clean Water Act of 1972, and so those are not our problem now. Our problem is a non-point, they call it. It's farm field runoff. Our algae bloom problems, our cyanobacteria problems are coming from phosphorus primarily. That's the big issue on the board right now. People know about Toledo. They know about the drinking water problems in Toledo. We had the same problems at the Des Moines Water Works. They haven't had to shut it down, but they have had blue-green algae toxins hit the waterworks. Originating in Black Hawk Lake, it came down the Raccoon River and hit the waterworks, and they had to struggle and spend a lot of money to try to kill that or destroy the toxins, eliminate the toxins, and kill that bacteria. That's the immediate threat I think that people are focused on right now is the drinking water supply for 500,000 people in central Iowa.
And you mentioned the Clean Water Act, the great gains that have been made in terms of industrial point sources and municipal point sources. There's also an effort now to categorize some of the confinement animal feeding operations as point sources and get them permitted by Clean Water Act.
The larger CAFOs are required to get a permit, but almost all the ones that are going up now are just a couple animals short of the limit, so they don't have to be permitted, which is a problem because we need farmers to know that when they put the manure on the field to get the nitrogen they need and the organic matter, which is fine, that's great, it's a great source of that, they're getting more phosphorus than they need. The phosphorus tends to move once you get phosphorus for your field. If you get a surplus, it tends to move with water. Farmers don't know that. They think the phosphorus always stays put, but like nitrogen, phosphorus will move with water into tiles and down tiles into the river.
And phosphorus is the big source of the blue-green algae blooms?
Absolutely. And people don't know this. This is the Citizens for Healthy Iowa is about educating people about how this works, the public, farmers. And who blocks, what organizations, what entities are blocking legislation that would improve the situation? So we're interested in the politics and the power plays and all of that. So we're trying to educate.
I see. And you're planning an event tomorrow, Thursday.
Right.
To show the force of citizen concern about these clean water issues.
Well, the citizens across the state are very concerned. Surveys and all show that water quality is the most important environmental concern of the public. But it doesn't seem to matter. I've been lobbying for 10 years, and the public can be concerned, but it doesn't get through to policy. And that's because of lobbying efforts from very powerful and very wealthy people.
Big ag.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how are you planning to raise this concern? You're going to meet people outside the Iowa State Fair at 1:30
We're going to meet at the Capitol at 1:30 and bus people over to the fairgrounds and then give them admission and give them some shirts about that emphasize the importance of clean water, that there are voters out there who are concerned about water. And what we're trying to do is make a connection between the politicians and their stance. And we can't get them to say anything. You know how it is. They are very careful about what they'll say, and Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter. They won't stand up for clean water because of the power, the overwhelming power of those who dole out money and are supportive of the candidates. So we have people without money and little organization across the state are very concerned. But it's not like the old days. It seems as though politicians don't respond to the public. They respond to money, and we see that, of course, you know, federal level, state level, big money. So they just blow away candidates who have support from regular people, I think.
Okay, and so the candidates who will be present at the fair on Thursday at 4 p.m. are rather significant candidates.
Yeah, I must say that when I got started in this, it was under the Vilsack administration. I attended the water conference that was created, and he attended, and the people from the DNR and all were just gung-ho on improving our water quality and the fishing and the habitat and all of that that goes with our waterways. So I was excited, and for many, many years, we have had great support from the DNR. And worked well with IDOLS and other agencies. But, wow, lately the hammer has come down on people like me. There's just like a barrier now when it comes to getting any kind of water quality measurement done or getting access to even information that we've collected over the past 10 years. Now that information is not available. The bill in the legislature last session that almost got passed that would have said the public will not be allowed to know what the water quality is as measured by the state in connection with the nutrient reduction strategy. It's not right. The public's put $18 million or so into this strategy, and some people claim that it's working, but most of us are seeing continuing degradation of our waters and our lakes, and we are told that there won't be any measurement. The federal government, through the EPA, sent a letter to Iowa and said, you guys are contributing too much to the dead zone in the Gulf. You've got to reduce your nitrogen and phosphorus by 45%. So the state of Iowa put together a report in response to that letter and said, okay, this is how we're going to do it. But, and even in the report, it says there'll be measurement. But I've been attending the meetings of those responsible for the strategy, and personally, I can't get anybody to commit to real measurement of water quality so we know where we're at, what the goals are, and how we're going to get there.
Yeah.
So
I've been talking to a lot of people who have this issue.
Yeah.
So tomorrow at the state fair, we have a debate for the leadership of our state between Governor Branstad and challenger Jack Hatch. That's at 4 p.m. You're planning to be present with a group of folks all wearing green T-shirts.
Well, there should be some media there. We'd like for, you know, to be on camera and at least for people, especially politicians, to know that there are people who care enough to come out, give their time, and stand there. And, you know, it seems like we've never done this before. I've never done this before. I've always thought reason and morality would work in our government. And so far, it's not. It is money and power. And we don't have any money and power. So what else can you do? Well, you just keep trying to educate and get your message out there and maybe force some politicians to actually take a stand on water quality and environmental health.
Okay.
And then the public will know who to vote for.
All right. We have to end it there. If folks want to get involved, they show up at the state capitol parking lot at 1:30 tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, contact Citizens for Healthy Iowa, and then we can plan better.
That sounds like a plan.
All
right.
Website. No.
Thank you, Michael Delaney, Citizens for Healthy Iowa.
Thank you, great opportunity for me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Michael. And we've been joined today by Doug Haar of Iowa Audubon. We've been talking about birding and bird conservation areas. And our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, and see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. You will also find lists of our guests and contact information to the organizations as we speak with and other resources mentioned on our shows. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Thank you, Greta. It's been wonderful hosting the program this morning.
Thank you, Pat, for the time I spent here.
And your participation as an audience makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.